Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program that looks into the jobs, incomes, finances, debts, child's problems of raising, the cost of raising kids, and all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Been a professor of economics all my adult life, and now I'm on the radio offering you the kinds of analysis that I used to do, mostly in the classroom, but I really do like doing it here in the public arena. Our new format has short updates, then I respond to the kinds of questions and comments we keep urging you to send to us, and my appreciation, you're doing it very, very well. And then in the second half of the program, we either have an interview, as we did last week, with Dr. Harriet Fraud, and we will have other interviews as well, or I go into depth in one or two topics, usually topics that you have asked me to consider. So let's jump right into it. Update number one for today. This has to do with an old problem that is getting worse. It's the problem around the word intern or internship. So let's start by a clear definition. And it runs something like this. I would like to have a job. However, I can't get a job because companies aren't hiring. I'm desperate because I look all around me at people like me, and we're not finding jobs the way we were thought or we were led to believe would be available to us. And we're very upset. And a kindly advice coming from friends, neighbors, teachers, be an intern. So we ask, what's that? That's when you go and work in an office, usually for a company, but possibly for a governmental agency, for no pay or for very, very little. And you're supposed to learn while you're there. You're an intern in the way that the doctor was an intern, having to learn procedures at the hospital and getting little pay because it was kind of part of his or her training. So you're an intern, you see. You're going to learn. And that's a substitute for being paid. And it'll look really good on your resume that you were an intern at thus and such a place, and maybe at least they'll write you a good letter of recommendation, even though they're not paying you. The number of interns has grown astronomically over the last 5 or 10 years, precisely because the job opportunities for people have dried up. And companies and offices know that there are lots of desperate people out there, particularly younger ones, coming out of high school, coming out of college, coming out of graduate school, professional schools, who are finding jobs hard to find, who are desperate, and you can get them to work and you don't have to pay them. You offer them instead an internship. Do they learn much? Who knows? More importantly, who cares? Most of these companies see the intern as a cheap source of labor. Cheap? Most interns get paid nothing. So here you've got a chance to get some work out of a person, and you don't have to pay them. And the young people are desperate. Being an intern is better than nothing. It gets something on your resume. Wow. The capitalist market, with its unemployment, its inability to provide jobs, has created the market in interns. So there's been massive abuse. Many, many internships turn out not to teach people anything they didn't already know, like running here and there and making photocopies, or collecting the coffee, or doing people's laundry, or answering the telephone, or a thousand other jobs where there's no learning that's relevant. It's free labor, that's the truth. Recently, there's been a spate of legal suits. Interns finally have had enough, and they've gotten lawyers, and they filed class action or other kinds of legal suits saying that their abuse as interns violated existing labor laws. Over the generations, working people fought hard for laws to be on the books that basically said You can't hire someone and not pay them. It's not a very complex idea. And so they've won some cases. I wanted to mention a couple. The publisher, the magazine publisher Condé Nast, which publishes Vogue magazine and Vanity Fair magazine, recently settled a suit brought by interns. It agreed to pay $5.8 million to settle a class action suit with roughly, get this, 7,500 former interns. Now, let's face it, that works out to $700 or $800 per intern, and that means that even after the lawsuit, these people were ripped off. There's no polite way to say it. Another example, NBC Universal. It also came to a settlement with 9,000 unpaid interns. I guess it was attractive or sexy to go work at an NBC Universal studio. And again, they got $6.4 million. So again, it works out to $700 or $800 per person. Hardly a compensation. Well, what do we have to say about this? Well, besides the horror and the abuse and the unfairness of it, a couple of things. First, interns as an existing phenomena is basically a favoritism to the rich. Let me explain how that works if you hadn't thought about it. If you're a poor person, if you come from a family with modest means, if you've had to work a lot to pay for school, when you graduate and start looking for a job, you have debts to pay, you have the cost of your life. You can't be an unpaid intern because then you can't pay for food and rent, basics. On the other hand, if you come from a wealthy family, you can. Your family will take care of you. You'll get the spending money you need for the apartment, for the food, for everything else. Meanwhile, you'll be able to get a nice-looking item on your resume. For rich people, internship gives them an added advantage over middle and lower-income people. If that isn't perverse, tell me what is. And here's a further one. With all this discussion, what do we get from our political leaders? Oh, they're going to look into it. Oh, they're going to pass some new regulations. They're going to be stricter. You really have to learn something on the job. Oh, sure. How hard is that going to be for an employer? Once a week for an hour, they'll talk to you about something. Get real. In this country, when we wanted to solve a problem, we don't fix it in this way by a little adjustment here, by a little adjustment there. We say, that's out. You can't do it. So, for example, we didn't say to the market in slaves, gee, let's be a little nicer. Let's not treat the slaves quite so badly. Well, we did that for a while. But then the pressure got too much, the fakery, the horror of it all. And what did we do? We ended slavery. That's how you solved that problem. I'll give you another example. In the early decades of this country, we allowed child labor. That's right, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old children spending all their lives, not in school, but in the factory, early in the morning to late at night. The kind of thing we now see all over the rest of the world, making the clothes we wear, the appliances we use, child labor. You can't get away with it here. You know why? We didn't just say, oh, treat the child a little better. Oh, let the child have a bathroom break. At a certain point, we understood that doesn't work. And so we said, no child labor. You cannot employ people under a certain age. End of story. That's what the intern problem is. Stop it. It is a gross abuse. And don't punish those who therefore can't get an internship. When you cancel interns, create the jobs that should have been provided to these people in the first place. Second update has to do with wealth. I wanted you, as I try periodically, to have a certain sympathy for the wealthy. They have their problems too. Here's what I learned that I wanted to share with you. Over the last, 20 years or so, as everybody knows, the rich have gotten richer and the rest of us haven't. And as we know from Emmanuel Saez, the researcher out at the University of California in Berkeley and his associates, the top 1% have really done better than everybody else. But what Saez and his associates also show us is that the top 0.1% has done even better. And the top 0.01%, by the way, that's 16,000 families who have $111 million or more. 16,000 families with that kind of money. They've done the best of all. And where is it showing up? I thought you would be interested. According to a report on the market for personal jet airplanes, the Citi Private Bank, deliveries of so-called light jets, the smaller, cheaper models, were down 17% last year from what they were the year before, and 67% down from the peak before this 2008 collapse hit. But deliveries of the biggest new private jets jumped 18% last year. You got it? Medium and small jets falling. And not enough wealth for them. But at the top, exploding. Wow. The same turns out to be true for yachts. Sales and orders of boats longer than 300 feet are at a record high. But prices for boats between 100 and 150 feet long are down 30 to 50%. Now you can understand with me how it's possible to talk to someone who has $50 or $100 million and have them look you right in the face and complain bitterly that they don't have enough money to live in the style to which they aspire. Because they're comparing themselves to the top 16,000 families, and they just can't do it. Next update, unemployment rate perception. A report in the website Vox, V-O-X, which you can find at vox.com, reports on a poll conducted by a famous polling service called Ipsos-Mori, M-O-R-I, Ipsos-Mori poll, turns out to discover something that surprised the poll takers. They asked people, what do you believe is the unemployment rate in the United States? And the average answer was 32%. Since the government unemployment number reported in the press is 6% roughly, the question is, what's going on? Why are the perceptions of people different from what the numbers are? My first reaction is to be surprised that they're surprised. Perceptions are one thing. The actuality of the numbers are always something else. It's not at all surprising that they're different. And it's even more important to understand that this isn't a question that one's right and one's wrong. Much more likely is that differences are emerging, that what one group thinks unemployment is governs what they get as the measure, and that another group has a different definition, and so not surprisingly, comes up with a different measure. So if you ask average people who's looking for a job and not finding one, their notion of who's looking and how you would know that is, of course, their own. They might identify their mother who's miserable at home and needs to get out but can't find the kind of job she wants. She's not counted by the government, but is she an unemployed person? Is the perception of her son or mother or nephew, her neighbor, correct? I would argue it probably is. We've always known that the actual extent of unemployment is larger than what government agencies like to find and like to admit. Is it that much larger? I think that depends on who's defining what when they're asked that question. Is an unemployed person someone who's in school but not happy there? Is it a person who's in a mental institution or a prison? Is it a person on parole who's having a hard time getting a job? Is it a person who says he or she has given up, but they haven't really? It's a big question. And I think we ought to be respectful and humble that if Americans think 32% of the people are unemployed, at the very least, it suggests that our unemployment problem is much bigger than what the government and the business community would like to believe. And by the way, when you talk to wealthy people about these things, they also have a difference of perception. Wealthy people, for example, believe in huge numbers that the reason there's unemployment is that people are lazy and not looking. When you tell them there are three times as many people unemployed as there are vacancies listed in any job vacancy list, they don't want to hear it. They don't think of it that way. They don't want unemployed people to be people for whom there is no job. They want the jobs to be there, and they want to be able to blame the people who don't have them. So how you think about society shapes what you might imagine is an objective number, but objective numbers have a way of being subjective much of the time. Finally, a wonderful poll taken by the Washington Post and some other newspapers on Election Day. They asked people coming out of the polling place, do you believe that government favors the wealthy? Politics and government faces the wealthy. And the answer is 64% of people who came out of the polls, and remember the polls were the victory for the Republicans. So we're talking about a lot of Republicans. 64% believe that politics and government in this society favor the wealthy. Just a perception, or maybe it's a deep insight. And there's a report by two researchers at sociology at the University of California in Berkeley, Brookman and Aller, that says, wow, we asked people the question, do you think we ought to tax the rich more? 67% of their poll said yes. 13%, one out of seven and a half people in America, said that there should be no incomes higher than $1 million a year, that there should be 100% maximum tax rate on every dollar over $1 million anybody earns. That's what Americans want. I'll leave it to you to see whether they get it. Okay, let me turn now in the time that we have. Time is always constrained. To some of your questions. A whole bunch of your questions came in that I want to deal with having to do with pensions. This is a very important question. Public pensions. What is going on with public pensions is really what I want to talk to you about. Working people who work for the local government, the state government, the federal government, have over the years, like workers everywhere, struggled to get better wages to take care of their families, to get better job conditions, and among other benefits, to get a pension, to get money set aside, money that they themselves contribute, and I'll come into that in a minute, put aside by the employer, whether it's public or private, so that when they retire, 65 to 70, more or less, they will have some way to live without being a burden on family, friends, children, and so on. The way this works, the employers always behave the same. They say to the worker, okay, if you want us to set up a pension fund, and if you want us to put money into the pension fund, that has to be basically your money. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a portion of your weekly wage or salary, not pay it out to you, put it aside in a fund, then we're going to invest that fund in stocks and bonds and hope it grows so that when you retire, that money will be paid out to you as a pension, a monthly check for your old age, in effect. Well, you say, but they also put money in. Not so quick. When the employer puts money in that the employer calls the employer's contribution, you can be very sure that when these plans were set up, the employer said to you or to the union representing you, if you want us to make a contribution from the employer, then that will be a substitute for giving you a wage increase. You're going to take a lower wage increase or no wage increase. You're going to take fewer benefits or cuts in your benefits. And instead of that, we're going to give you a pension plan into which we, the employer, is going to make a contribution. So however you slice it, the pension is money out of your pocket. It either literally is withheld from your paycheck, or it's something your employer puts in that you didn't get as a wage increase because it really was part of the package you were negotiating. Why do I stress this? Because a pension is your money. A pension is your money set aside. The only thing to keep in mind, and I'm getting to that, is what happens to the money as it is set aside by you, by the employer, by both of you, every week in terms of your paycheck. And that's the important thing for today's conversation. That money is invested. The company usually chooses, and they get advantages from this, chooses an investment company. The money is given to the investment company, and they buy stocks and bonds in the stock market. They're supposed to do it carefully. They're supposed to do it in order that it grows. They're supposed to make it develop so that more and more wealth is there to be able to pay you when you retire. All right. That's what usually happens. Now follow me. In 2008, we had a stock market meltdown. We actually had another one back in the year 2000. We came back from that, and whack, we got it again in 2008. The end result is that over the last decade or so, the rate of growth of the invested money for pensions collapsed. The rate of growth much smaller than it was in the previous 10 or 20 years. Nobody prepared for that. And it means that pensions today are nowhere near as large as they were expected to be, because everybody in the 1980s and 1990s, seeing pensions go up when the stock market did, made the happy assumption that what was true of growing stock market values then would always be true. Did that make sense then? No. The ball that goes up comes down. Stock markets that go up go down. And that's what happened. In the last 10 years, the rate of growth of the stock market has been poor, much poorer than in the previous 10 or 20 years. That's because we've had major economic downturns. That's why, here comes the punchline, that's why today, particularly in the public sector, although it's also true in the private, but particularly in the public sector, government, the pensions available to pay out people, and because of the age composition of our society, we're having more and more people reach retirement age, many more than did so in the 1980s and 90s. So we have more and more people becoming retired, turning to a pension fund, expecting it to have in it what they thought the growth rate would be, but which the economy frustrated. It is our capitalist economic system's meltdown. First, early in 2000, and then again in 2008 and 9, that have produced much lower rates of growth. It is not that working public employees have suddenly gotten better pensions. They haven't. Over the last 10 or 12 years, while the value of the shares invested in pensions haven't gone up, the amount of money put in by workers has increased. The amount of money put in by employers, really on behalf of their workers, has increased. The workers have put in more, but the pension hasn't grown because the stock market wasn't going up enough. There was a capitalist downturn, one in 2000, another one in 2008. And the end result is pensions, here we go, don't have enough wealth in them to meet the demand. What then are people doing? Here's the horror of it. The wealthy and the big businesses are afraid that since the economic downturn is what hurt the pensions, it's going to be their responsibility, or at least they're going to have to pick up a big part of the cost of making good the pensions that were promised to working people, that they got instead of the wage increases they otherwise would have gotten. The businesses are afraid they're going to have to pay for part of this, and they don't want to. So what are they doing? They're saying, oh, there's a pension crisis, and workers should do with less. They are cutting the pensions, either through bankruptcy proceedings or by pressure on politicians. In other words, they're trying to suggest that there's some kind of fault among the workers that explains the problem of pensions. But as I've tried to explain to you, the problem of pensions is not what workers put in. It's not what workers are putting in now. And it's not any increase in what workers are entitled to. The problem is the fact that the pension values were hobbled by stock market reverses, slowed down drastically from what had been projected. And that, at the very least, is society's problem. It's the problem of an economic system that works this way, which we have a taboo against discussing, but which ought to be discussed, heaven knows. In the little bit of time we have left, let me respond to another set of questions. These have to do with mortgages. What is a mortgage again? Let's be real clear. A mortgage is simply a special name for a special kind of loan. It's the loan you take out to buy a home, a house, a co-op, a condo, whatever. If you borrow money to buy a home, a piece of property like that for a home, it's called a mortgage loan. That's all. Just a word for housing loan. Think of it that way. Mortgages are known in the way I just spoke, namely as loans to buy a home. And that's what they were until about 10, 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago. They were mostly, or maybe even 30, I have to go back a little further, till the 1980s, most mortgage loans were loans taken out by people who wanted to buy a home. Young people starting a family, things like that. Over the last 20, 25 years, that has changed. And mortgage loans are now less than half to buy a home. Well, what's the other half? The other half is called refinancing. And here's what it means. If you have a house, an apartment, and it goes up in value, the higher the value of your house, the more you can borrow, giving to the lender the collateral of your house. Let me explain. The old style of mortgage, when you borrowed money to buy a house, here's how it worked. The lender gave you the money. You go out and buy the house. But you had to sign a document which said that if you didn't make your monthly payments to the lender to pay back with interest the loan you got to buy the house, the lender could take your house because you weren't paying. Your house was collateral for the mortgage loan. What has begun to happen is that people who have a house discovered that you can borrow more if the value of your house goes up, because as the value of your house goes up, you have more collateral. You have more of a guarantee to give a lender. So it turns out that in recent years, more than half of mortgage loans are not to buy a home, but to pull more loan out of the home you already have. End result has been that without anybody knowing it, kind of below the radar, more and more Americans own less and less of their houses. They've borrowed so much by refinancing, by borrowing more out of their house, using their house's rising value, but it means that more and more of the house is really owned by the bank. You only own a small portion of it because you're so indebted with the house as the collateral. What it also means is that young people are going to discover when their parents die that the house they thought would come to them won't come to them because most of the value of that house is pledged as collateral for a loan. And what will be left to them after the loan is paid off will be a very small amount of value, much less than the value of that home. That's one of the results of this refinancing, or as some people like to say, converting your home into a piggy bank from which you keep taking loans. It's something that older folks can do without showing anybody that their finances and their assets are becoming fewer and fewer as they go deeper and deeper into debt. We've come to the end of the first half of our program. Please stay with me. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update, and we'll be back very shortly. Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. This is the second half of today's program. I want to remind you before we jump in that we maintain two websites, rdwolff2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. They are available to you without any charge 24/7. They contain all kinds of materials, video, audio, written materials. All of the archives of these programs are available to you there, again, all at no charge. The websites are also ways for you to communicate to us, to send us questions, comments, suggestions, which we use to shape this program. And I'll have more to say about that toward the end of today's program. The first topic, and it's an immense topic, but one that you've asked me to talk about, that I want to go into in some depth, is the way an economy divides income into two sorts. I'm not going to be talking about income of rich and poor, although you're going to see that we're going to touch on that. I want to talk in a different way. There are two ways to make income in our capitalist kind of economy. And often there's a loss of an appreciation for what this means. Let me explain. First, you can earn an income by working. That's, in fact, how the vast majority of people in our culture earn income. They work. They receive a wage. They receive a salary. And the basic idea is when you work, you help to produce the goods and services we have as an economy, and a portion of those are given back to you in response, in payment, for the work you did. So you produce and you get. And you get because you produce. You use your brains and your muscles to produce things, to convert a tree into a chair, to convert a blank piece of paper into a software program, whatever. You work. But there is a fundamentally second way you can get income in a capitalist system. And this is not by working. You do not have to expend your brains, and you do not have to expend your muscles, your energy. What is it that you have to get this second kind of income? And the answer is property. You have to own something that generates income. I'll give you the obvious examples. If you own land, well, then it can generate to you a rental payment. That is, you make the land available to somebody else, and in exchange for your doing that, that person pays you a rental sum. So you earn an income, not because you're doing anything, you're just giving someone else access to what you own. The important thing is you own. You don't have to give it to anybody. In order for someone to get access to make use of it, they got to pay you, and that's your income. Second example, you own money. You can sit on the money. That's what owning means. You can stare at it all day long. That won't generate you any income. But if you allow someone else to have it for a year, then that person signs a document with you. It's called a loan agreement. He or she gets to use your money for a year. At the end of that time, that person has to give you back that money plus an interest payment. That's your income. That interest is your interest income. You didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to use your brains and muscles. You just allowed someone temporary access to what you own, just like the person with land did. Finally, you can own a machine, a factory, an office, a software program, a license. Again, you own something. You can sit and stare at it. But if you make it available to somebody else, if you give it to a company that makes something, then they have to pay you a fee for doing that. They may pay you a dividend for the shares of stock you own, money you paid in at some point. Okay? You can earn money by work, or you can earn money by property. Let's examine these. Property. Land. Let's start with the land. Did the person who owns the land produce the land? The answer is obviously no. The land exists on this planet. However this planet got separated from the rest of the universe is a mystery barely understood by astronomers and physicists. But we do know that whoever owns the land, that person didn't produce the land. So what matters is not you produced it. What matters is you own it. You have the legal right to withhold it. Now let's talk about that. In a community, people need to eat, don't they? And eating requires that we use land. Land to grow crops. Land to feed animals. Land to raise the chickens. You know the story. So for the community, for the economy, for any country to exist, it needs land in order to produce the food without which life isn't possible. If we make land private property, which in capitalism we do, other systems don't, but in capitalism we do, then we are basically saying that we're going to give to some people the legal right, which we enforce with police and prisons and troops, the legal right to look at the community and say, we are not going to make the land available for growing food unless we get paid. You don't pay us, you can't use the land. That's what private property means. So in capitalism, since communities don't want to starve, they basically have worked out an arrangement whereby they give to the landholder, the owner, a part of what we produce in society. That's their income. They didn't produce the land. They do not need to work on anything. They don't help grow the crops. Not at all required. People who work to grow the crops get a wage and a salary because they're working. The only reason they get an income is because they own. Now, only property is what they have. In the case of land, it's particularly egregious because they didn't produce what it is they own. But it turns out, if you talk to the owner of a factory or the owner of an office, they will, unless they're very strange people, also admit to you they didn't produce those machines. They wouldn't know how. They didn't build that building. They've never touched a brick and do not know exactly what cement is. So the people who own the land are actually like the people who own the factories, the offices, and the machines. They didn't make what they own. They may have inherited it from somebody else. They may have stolen it in some hustle. Or, possibly, they may have operated a business where they took the profits from that business and accumulated machines, factories, buildings. But let's look at that. Let's look at it carefully. They had a business where they made profits. And what are profits? That's when the workers come and produce more than you pay them. That's what profits are. When you get that job for $20 an hour, you know that the only reason the employer pays you $20 an hour is because during that hour you produce more than $20 worth of whatever it is the company makes. He's going to sell that more than $20. He's going to pay you $20, and he's going to have left the profit. And if he uses that to accumulate buildings and factories, it's all very nice that he made that decision. But he did it with the work you, the employee, did. So in the end, the land is produced by nobody, and the factories, offices, and machines are produced by workers. So how come the workers don't get it? How come the community as a whole doesn't enjoy the value of the land? And the answer is property. We allow in capitalism property to be owned, the owner to have the right to withhold it from production. We all need the production to survive, so we pay the owner a cut of what we all produce. Capitalism is that system of coercion, of using private property as a way to draw from the community part of what it produces because of the threat that if you don't give us a big part of what you produce, you will not be able to produce anything. It's a little bit like a poker bluff, isn't it? Let me get at this another way. Let's suppose that in a community there are 100 people, any community. And let's suppose that 50 of them work every day, using their brains and muscles to produce goods and services. If the people who produce take all of what they've produced for themselves, then 50 people will be working, they'll produce an output, and they will consume, those 50, what they produced. They'll get what they produced. But that would mean the other 50 will die. They don't have any food, they don't have any clothing, they don't have any shelter. Why? Because the people who work use their brains and muscles, typically adult, able-bodied men and women, are consuming, taking for themselves as their income everything that they produce. Well, the point of the story is simple. No society works like that. All societies have always been a group of people in the community work and produce output. They take part of what they produce for themselves to consume. And the rest of it is distributed to other people so that they can live. The punchline. The only way people can consume who don't help to produce is if the people who produce don't consume all that they produce. The only way the child is fed, clothed, and sheltered is if the parents take a portion of their income and make it available to the child. For children to eat, the adults in the community have to produce more than the adults themselves consume so that the rest can be given to the children. Well, in capitalism, we add a little wrinkle, don't we? Everybody who produces, produces more, not for their children, not for anybody in their community that they choose, but for that employer. They produce an extra, a surplus, a profit for the employer. And they have to, because the employer won't make available the land, if that's what he provides, or the machines, or the raw materials, or the building that he provides. He won't provide it unless you produce more than he has to give you back out of what you produce, and he keeps the rest. That's how people accumulate property, by grabbing a portion of what the community as a whole produces. In other words, private property feeds on itself, builds itself. That's how capitalism works. The more you have, the more you can go to the community and say, you want to have me make this available for you to produce? Give me a cut. You really needy? Give me a bigger cut. As much as the market will bear. Why do I stress this? Because many of our economic problems derive from this situation. Is it in fact fair? Is it even reasonable? Is it efficient to work things out this way? We wouldn't have to. We could say, for example, that the people who do the work, together with the people who don't work, for whatever reason, they're sick, they're too young, they're too old, whatever, together decide how to divide up what the able-bodied are producing in a kind of democratic, collective way. The property wouldn't be privately owned then. The property would be the owned means of production of the economy as a whole, the collective means of production. We would decide how to use them, but nobody gets paid anything because we're a community of people who decide what to do with our output, whether to replace machinery we use up, whether to have more machinery. Those are all social decisions that we make. But we don't allow individuals in the midst of us to have the control to withhold from everybody what we as a community need. That's not a community. That's a community split apart between the owners and those without property. This is a very old issue. Capitalism doesn't surmount it. Capitalism doesn't avoid it. Capitalism is right in it. And I think it's worth thinking about. Last point. Throughout human history, going back thousands of years, human beings have looked at private property, seen the way the owner threatens, in effect, the rest of the community. If you don't give me a cut of what you're producing, then I'm not going to allow you to have what I own and that what you need to live. Communities have said this is dangerous. Communities have noticed that people who have property use it to get even more property. We certainly see that around us, don't we? So what communities over thousands of years have done, and this is in the Bible for those of you who take Christianity seriously, and in other religions you see the same thing. There is something which, at least in Christianity, and I believe in Judaism also, is called Jubilee. It's an interesting name. Every few years, every 10 years, every 30 years, it varies from culture to culture and from time to time. But every few years, the religion said, we're going to cancel all debts. We're going to redistribute the property. The rich will have to give it up to the middle and the poor, and people who were rich will be poor for a while, people who were poor will be rich for a while, but we won't even allow the big differences to exist. We're going to equalize, basically the idea, equalize everything and start again. You know why they did that? Because they said that's the only way to keep our communities from blowing up, from a level of tension, envy, bitterness, opposition, mistrust, all of the sins that can destroy a community. They come with growing inequality. So we're going to solve that problem by periodically canceling the debts, redistributing the property, so we don't get those extremes, and if we do, we cancel them. That's another recognition of what I'm trying to explain. Interesting that the people who take Christianity seriously this day have an interesting habit of not remembering the part about Jubilee. In the time that remains, I want to talk about another issue that keeps coming up in many of your questions. This has to do with regulations. Your questions take the form, for example, can't we regulate our way out of this problem? Can't we pass a law that will deal with this sort of thing by making changes? So, for example, solve the problem of inequality by raising tax rates to what they were years ago, or what would be fairer, or what would be more egalitarian, or whatever is in your mind. Let us put a limit on interest rates. Banks should not be able to raise interest rates above a certain amount. Let's put a minimum on wages. You shouldn't be able to have pay a worker less than something, a living wage or something like that. Or we shouldn't allow monopolies. There should always be. You hear what I'm saying? There are regulations. And many societies have regulations on their economic activities. I understand the impulse behind it, and I advocate regulations myself also. But I do it with an awareness that there is something halfway about a regulation. There's something overcautious about a regulation. There's something even namby-pamby about a regulation. Here's what I mean. Sometimes a problem runs so deep and is so troubling to the well-being of a community that what you need is not a regulation. You need a fundamental change. And I'm going to use an example that I've used before, even in this program. Example number one. We had slavery in the United States for a long time after we became an independent nation and broke away from Britain. We had slavery. And there were clearly horrible abuses in our slave system. Masters abused slaves in every way imaginable. Abusive physically, abusive sexually, abusive in just treating their families, breaking up their families. It's an awful story. We know that story. And so well-meaning people looking at that, willing to be honest in facing it, and I'm talking about Southerners as well as Northerners, even though it was a Southern phenomenon in the United States, but there were plenty of people in the South who understood what they saw. And they advocated regulations. Let's put a rule that you can't beat a slave. Let's put a rule that you can't separate a mother from her children if they're in a slave family. Let's make a rule. You get the idea. And the rules were passed, and they may have had some salutary effect. I'm not arguing that. I'm sure they did sometimes. But the bottom line was they left intact an institution which, even where it might have been less harsh than it was somewhere else, still left us with a situation that was fundamentally untenable, unacceptable, and socially dangerous. And so a demand rose to do something more than regulate. And the something more was called abolition. End slavery. Don't regulate it. Don't fix it around the edges. Don't, at the margin, make it a little less awful. This is an institution for which we have a solution, and the solution is abolition. I'll give you another example. Child labor. In the early decades of this country's history, and for quite a while, we allowed child labor. That means children as young as 5 and 6 years of age brought into factories for 5, 10, 15 hours a day, doing unspeakable labor, not getting an education, very unhealthy conditions, etc., etc., etc. And again, we had well-meaning people saying, well, let's see, let's not allow child labor unless you're at least 7, or let's demand that if you have child labor, you have a separate toilet for children, you give them a lunch break, you have decent air, you require them to have 1 hour of schooling, 100 efforts to regulate child labor so it's not as awful as it was when you didn't regulate it. And once again, it was discovered that this really isn't adequate, that the children, even in places where regulations took effect, where they had better conditions, it still struck human beings, and I'm proud of this in the United States, it struck large numbers of Americans. This is an institution to which you do not answer, how can we regulate it to make it better? Instead, you say, abolish this institution. And so we did. Child labor was abolished, like slavery was abolished. It's a little bit like if I stood in front of you today and said we have a problem called sexual harassment at the workplace, where people in authority impose or demand sexual services or favors from those underneath them in the hierarchy of a business. And we have these days all kinds of rules and regulations about it. But the bottom line is, this has to be abolished. It's not that you're supposed to be polite when you impose this on a person below you in the bureaucracy. You're not supposed to do it. It has to be abolished, not regulated. Why do I stress this? Because we live in an economic system today, and there's no getting around this, that is producing unacceptable results, a gap between rich and poor that's unbearable. The kinds of suffering of children that last week's program so graphically presented, and also in the work that Dr. Fraud shared with us. So we're not dealing with a system that is working real well subject to regulations. We're needing a system, we're living in a system that needs something else. And we'll continue with this in the next program. But you can see where we're going. This is Richard Wolff. I want to thank you for being with me. I want to thank truthout.org, a remarkable source of independent news and analysis that I urge you to check out. I also want to remind you that we are a program that depends on your support, just as do the radio stations that enable you to hear this and the services that enable you to hear this. Please support them, and if you're so disposed, go to our websites, rdwolf.com with two Fs and democracyatwork.info. They will provide you not only with ways of communicating to us, but providing support if at this time of year you're in a position to do that. Thank you very much. And I look forward to being with you again next week.